Welcome. Thank you. Welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of O-Readers Anonymous. Visit our website, oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep the special service active. The opinions expressed are those of the individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive reader and a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Welcome, Kendall, from a compulsive overeater from New Jersey.
Hello, everybody. My name is Kendall, recovering compulsive overeater. Before we begin, I would just like to take a second, center in prayer. God, help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, this disease, about compulsive overeating, about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, about Overeaters Anonymous, and all of life so that I might have a new experience with you and to come to know you better in all of these things. Please help me to see the truth. Amen. Okay, as I said before, my name is Kendall. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. Glad to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to be serviced. Before I get started, I just want to say that this is not my doing. This is my higher power's doing. It's really important for me to center my higher power in my recovery, whom I call God. If God gets the credit, I find that I get the benefits from this program. When it's my program, like when it's me that's doing it, it's where a lot of destruction has come in my life. To show that the program works, to start with a little bit of basic data, I've been in recovery since November 11th of 2020. I was struck abstinent then. I had a brief relapse and reset my time September 4th, I'm sorry, of 2021, and I've been abstinent now for 3 years and a little over 3 months. My highest weight before coming into this program by medical records, which I think I was above this weight, was 482 pounds. And I have now had a weight release of 174 pounds over these last 3 years in recovery. I'm going to just briefly, I know that the folks that will be listening to this later won't be able to see these pictures, but I will share briefly some photos. I have three of them to share. Go. So the picture that's on the left is probably just is in the beginning of the pandemic. So it's I was outside in spring. I was living in Texas, and we were out at a berry garden. This picture on the right is probably a couple of years before, but I don't remember what year. But I had kind of like a smirk, but not really a smile. And this picture in the center is from 2023, the fall of 2023. It's perhaps one of the few pictures I have a real smile on, because one of the things about this program and about this disease, specifically about this disease of compulsive overeating, is it takes away so much happiness. I was in a lot of pain, and so when I tell my story, I want to do my best to focus on what it was like, meaning what the disease was like, what it was like to be in compulsively eating in the food, what happened, so what brought me to the fellowship, my bottom, and the working the steps of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as redefined for the Overeaters Anonymous, and what it's like now, so where I'm at in my program today and what I do today. But I will spend some time reflecting upon it as a beginner. The last thing I want to share before I start my story is just that this is my experience, strength, and hope with the steps. And I find that it helps my recovery, but your mileage may vary. I don't want to sound like an expert. If anything that I am saying does not align with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or with Overeaters Anonymous with this fellowship, please discard it. Please take what you like and leave the rest. I really want to center that it's this program, not Kendall, that works. Okay, with that, I'll start the story. For me, it was really important to define that to talk about really what it was like as a kid. I grew up in a very high anxiety home. I'll spare you a lot of what the details were, but a lot of it was around financial insecurity. And there are a lot of people in and out of the house. It was a crazy time. And for me, I was always a pretty bright kid, pretty smart and learned things pretty quickly. But I always felt like I was running a little higher, like my engine was running a little faster than everyone else's around me. And that was because of the constant thoughts. I had a lot of thoughts. It was very fast. It was a highly anxious kid. And the only thing that quieted that voice for me really was the food. It was the first thing that was actually a solution for me. The food brought me peace. And so before I can remember, I was definitely a compulsive overeater. There were certain substances I always knew. That was any type of flour and any type of sugar. I knew those things once they entered my body. I got peace. I got a sense of comfort, sense of ease and comfort from those foods. And nothing could get between me and getting them. I would get up in the middle of the night. I remember one of the first binges that I ever had. I didn't call it a binge because I didn't know that word. But I was probably 4 years old. I got up on a chair and I was staying at my dad's house and I grabbed a bunch of cookies and I ate all of the cookies in my bed and I didn't throw away any of the wrappers or any of the stuff. And I remember my dad yelled at me and I felt a lot of shame. But then I remember that after I experienced the shame, he felt bad, I think, for probably for yelling at me. And we went out to eat. So I just had this experience of, okay, on the other side of shame, on the other side of anything, at least I would get food. So no matter what was happening, at least I got food. I grew up as a kid that also with the split family, and my parents were never married, so I always had this these carrying separate lives of secrets in different homes. My dad was remarried, so I was always there was a way that I needed to act when I was there, and there was a way I needed to act when I was with my mom, who I stayed with mostly. The majority of my upbringing is with my mom. And I had this sense of seeking validation from my father. I wanted to impress him and I wanted to impress my mom. I thought that what I could do, if I could do more or be more in my life, that I could make the stress go away and my life would be normal. Like I could be like all the other kids. So because I knew, because I was always overweight, I knew that if I was fat, I could at least be smart, funny, rich, and powerful. That's how my brain works. I wanted to take over the world. One of the lines in Bill's story that I really connected to when I first came to the program, I'll come back to it, but I always bring it up. It's because it's me, and it's really one sentence. I proved to the world I was important. It's on page two. I was just for sure that I was going to prove to everybody that I wasn't a waste of time. I was enough because I didn't really believe it. And so my whole life, when I was in the food and out of the food, has been trying to make sure that I was enough and making sure that people could see me succeed. It was more important to be seen doing good things than it was doing good things themselves. Social media was really bad for me, because that idea of being able to chase validation and seeing all those things in my life. One of the things to share as well, in the food, what it's like in the food. I tried every diet. If it was in a book that I could buy at the store, I bought most of them at bookstores, and I was very good at doing the diet, and then as soon as I closed the book, I closed the diet. And so, I'd make it through their plan of the 6 months or 3 months or whatever, and then I'd get to this part where they say reintroduce certain types of foods, and then I was off to the races. I've tried diets where I've eliminated certain types of things, certain carbohydrates. I've done diets where I've eliminated fats. I did a diet where I eliminated all other things except for animal proteins. I tried intermittent fasting. I tried without knowing it, just trying to listen to my body and to intuitively eat. And all of those things did not work for me. My body wants me to eat until I die. And I don't know why. I've never understood it. I've also been the person that would clean up the plates and eat the food. after the holidays, because I was a flour, sugar, and a volume eater. Certain when I eat more, I want more, and I never really understood why. One of the things, though, with the food is that in or out of the food, I also experienced a lot of my character defects. One of the key ones for me was in that seeking of validation was trying to see what other people thought of me, and it was also creating stories about other people. So I was a really big gossiper in my early parts of my job. I was the first person to character assassinate. If I knew someone might have a skill that I had or was going to be my competition, I tried to shoot them down as quickly as I could. I just, it was not a pretty thing. I really leaned into a lot of those character defects. Ego, I'd love to know more than other people, and I like to make people look bad if I knew the answer to something and they didn't. I liked to derail conversations and question people, make professors uncomfortable with my questions. And I loved to look like the expert on any situation. Needless to say, this food and this problem that resides in my mind, because I'll talk about what it, you know, that's a lot of what it was like, but I'll talk about what happened 2 years before I came to OA. I went into diabetic ketoacidosis, which is where my blood sugar was over 400. My A1C was over 12, and I went into the ICU. I couldn't see well. I was slurring my speech. My tongue was dry, and my wife had to drive me to the emergency room, and they treated me like I was dying. They had to put IVs into my arteries because my veins had all collapsed. I was really a mess, and the doctors there, you know, telling me that I was going to take insulin for the rest of my life, and that if I ended up there again, I could die. And again, me knowing everything, I just knew that the answer was somewhere in my head. I said I was talking to these nurses and doctors about insulin resistance at 480 plus pounds. Like that, I knew the answer. I was essentially just saying I've got this to these people. And so then when I left, I lost about 100 pounds, and I gained 125 back in a very short period of time. Every time I lost weight, I always put it back on with interest. And that went on for 2 more years. And so in 2020, November 11th, 2020, I came into OA, and I was still looking for an answer. I was like, well, where's this diet, and where's the, what's the OA diet? And this is just going to be like a pay and way with prayer, right? You know, that's what I thought, that all I was going to do is just going to come here and pray and look like I was doing what everybody else was doing, because that was my story. If I could look good while doing it, I could get the validation that was necessary. I would get the cash and prizes, and then I would go home. So I was convinced that once I came to this place, that something, I was going to be able to figure it out. That came quickly after my first day, but I think first true moment of humility was that first meeting where I identified as a compulsive overeater. I heard a woman share her story, and it sounded like my life, but it was weird because she was well adjusted and had friends and wanted to be around everybody that she was around in her life. And I realized that I'd had none of those things. But so my ego was deflated very quickly for a day and then reinflated itself right away in a way. But so with that, was that crushing admittance that I was powerless over food. That was very clear to me. A couple of things for me, in the doctor's opinion. One of the first things that I always looked for, so on Roman numeral pages 28, it said that the manifestation of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. So this idea that there's the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. All of that made sense to me. And then it said these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. That was really okay. I get it. So for me, I identified my foods, alcoholic foods, and alcoholic behaviors. So flour and anything that looks like bread, that was really clear to me. I got honest right away. Sugar and sugar substitutes are on that list for me. I know I can't touch those. Over time in recovery, dairy came up for me. I can't do dairy in any kind, including butter. I can't eat nuts because they all trigger this allergy of the body. Once I eat one, I can't stop. And volume, when I don't weigh and measure my food, for me, not ha having that play in the joints hurts me. I have to eat a meal soberly, even when I go out. Someone has to know the exact substances of what I'm eating, and it has to be okayed by a sponsor or by someone else who has the same form of the disease as me. My eyes don't work correctly when I eat. So I really fully understood this idea and took it to heart about being surrendered to being powerless over this allergy of the body. The obsession of the mind is where I got really stuck because I always look for answers as to why I did X, Y, or Z thing. And I was like, well, why am I an alcoholic with food? Why am I a compulsive overeater? What is this? And a very pungent sentence at the bottom of Roman numeral 28 in the doctor's opinion says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. There it is. For me, it feels good. That's it. I wish it was something else. I wish it was like because of how I was raised as a kid. I wish it was because of how I was taught to eat, that I was a baby that was born on formula, all this, whatever the things are. I wanted it to be anything other than I just do stuff that feels good. And what I found was that this effect, right? Reading on, it says the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot admit, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Yeah, I thought food was the solution. And they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks or bites. I always, just as a side note, for me, I always put the words for compulsive eating in there in my head. And I also write out these things in first person, which was direction from my sponsor. Every line that I identify with in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have written out on separate paper that's like, yes, this is me. I am this thing. I have this thing. And so it says, sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks or bites, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. This word impunity. Seeing people eat food and get away with it used to drive me nuts. I would see thin people walk into fast food restaurants and get whatever they wanted. And I remember complaining about that a lot, particularly early in my recovery. And so I really wanted this psychic change that they talk about. So once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being required that to follow a few simple rules. And I thought at first, okay, the rules are just food. But one line in more about alcoholism, there's a small paragraph on page 30, where I have to work is a lot is we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people pre or presently may be has to be smashed. So that didn't just mean around the food, that meant around how I see the entire world. What's enough recognition? I don't know what enough money is. I don't know what enough validation is. I don't know what real friendship is like sometimes. Very often, particularly when I was in the disease and before recovery, all relationships in my life were transactional because I thought everybody was temporary, including myself. So it was really just important what I could get from someone was more important than certainly than what I could give to them or what they meant intrinsically to anyone else. It was what they meant to me. What could I get from this conversation? What could I get from this next business deal? What could I get from this relationship to get me a better grade in a class or whatever I could manipulate? I wanted to know what I had control over. So the idea, so in that step one, being powerless over food. It's that second part of my life being unmanageable. I was convinced for so long that if I could just put the food down, that I could fix my life. And what I found was that in this program, my life A lot of things got crazier as I still didn't hand over my life to something else. In the step two, in coming to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, it took me a long time to really admit that I was insane. But again, as I was talking about these ideas of what was going on in my personality, and coming from a background, my background in my life was as a with religion and with spirituality. I've been a seeker my entire life of knowledge. So I had read most religious texts by the time I was 16 years old, from the east, the west, north, the south. I read everything because I just wanted to know more stuff than people, but I didn't really practice their dictates or the philosophies. When I was trying to impress my father's a pretty religious man, and I would really try to lean into and almost pretend like I believed the same way that he did, but I was really just borrowing someone else's higher power. And but the way that I saw that higher power as a kid was, you give me, God gave me the answers to all of my problems, and if I couldn't solve them myself, I was stupid. And so when I couldn't stop eating, I thought, it's like I prayed so many times for gluttony to be removed from me and a litany of other vices which have taken me into other fellowships in my life. But I thought I could just pray and just tell God I wanted it taken, but I didn't need to change anything.
10 minutes.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you for your service. I thought that, oh man, if I could just pray and be seen praying that, the right people would come into my life and that I could be changed, and all of a sudden I wouldn't have to really do anything different. I didn't really have to change my life. I just had to publicly admit that I had a problem. I thought that's all I had to do. Fall on the sword, so to speak, in public, and then all of a sudden I would be saved. I would be fixed. I didn't really understand that the spiritual actions were the actions that I had been taking beginning in OA. In beginning in OA, when I got honest about my food and started to re I reported it to my sponsor, and I take a picture, which I still do to this day, every meal. When I started doing that, a lot of feelings started to come up, but I started to realize that, and as I read We Agnostics, I realized that I was an agnostic. I didn't really believe that my higher power could come to me in this issue of my addiction and could help me. It said, on page 45, it says, we could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. I did not have the power to fix myself with this food. But when I started leaning into this fellowship, I started having this experience that every time I wanted to eat, I did not eat. I would call someone and I would tell them what was happening in my life. And I would say, I'm going to go to this insert fast food place. I'm going here. It's over. I've given this OA thing enough. And someone would stay on the phone with me until I didn't eat. I had this experience of, I'm going to tell off these people at my job and I'm going to write this email. And I call someone and I call my sponsor and he says, well, maybe you shouldn't do that. Why don't you consider not doing that? Or what would it look like if you were of service today instead? And I started doing those things and having the experience where my life wasn't blowing up, even though I was 100% convinced that if I wasn't operating in the world doing stuff my way, it was going to crash and burn. Because the thing that was the one of the most important phrases to me in my life was, if it's to be, it's up to me. I thought that if something was going to happen, I had to make it happen, other because no one was going to help me. Not a single person was going to help me. I felt so alone in this disease that I was just going to be left to die. I never wanted to kill myself, but I said so many times, nobody would even care if I left. I didn't consider my parents, they'd be happier. They'd be happier without me. My whole life, all the people that know me, everyone would be better off because I was killing myself with this food. And I realized that this disease wants me alone and dead. It wants me alone and dead and settled for me wounded, loves it when I push people away. And this is the only place where people didn't push me away. I would yell at meetings, and I remember almost flipping tables and getting angry because when the food was down and calling people and complaining about things. And I remember yelling at my sponsor and him telling me he loved me. I remember, going to meetings and just being out of my gourd and people just saying, keep coming back. So much love came to me unconditionally through this fellowship that I had no choice but to realize that the power, the higher power that I believed in, the God that I said I believed in, I did not. I had a knowledge, but I did not have a relationship with a higher power. And so in reading the Gnostic, I had to realize that. When we announced, sorry. And in the chapter How It Works, pages, my sponsor gave me an assignment to write out from page 60 to page 60, 63, in the first person, which I did. And that was really telltale for me, particularly the line, the first requirement is that I be, and this is on page 60. The first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. It was really important for me to say that in the I language. Another one was, I, our actor. So I am self-centered. On this is page 61. I am self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. I'm like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, so on and so forth.
5 minutes.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks for your service. So in that, I read from pages 60 to 63, and working with my sponsor, when I took step three, I was to understand that taking step three was turning my life and will over to the care of God as I understood God at that very moment in time, which was not at all. I didn't know what I understood, but I knew that my way meant I was going to die. That's all I really understood. And I knew that other people had what I wanted. So I had to make this first step of faith. And when I took my third step, I didn't have the sense of any relief, really. But what did happen was at that sense, I got a, what I didn't realize was that I got such a jolt of willingness to continue. So some of the people that I follow in some of the mothership program, they talk about taking third step as an agreement to work steps four through nine. So I immediately went about a course of action of doing writing down my inventory. And in these last 5 minutes, I will summarize what that experience was like for me. I got really angry. I realized that I stepped on the toes of so many people in my life, and it was a reverse golden rule. What I was afraid was going to be done to me, I had done to others. Places where I thought people were going to steal from me, I stole first. People that thought I was going to be abandoned by, I abandoned them. Work relationships, I cut them off. I talked about people and said evil things about them before they had a chance to say anything about me because they weren't even thinking about me. So many of the things that happened in my life were machinations of my own disease. Also, in my fourth step, I realized that I wanted people, particularly when it got to my parents, I wanted people to love me in a way of which they were not capable of. They had no idea how to do it. I was self-seeking in what I wanted for love from people. I wanted an unconditional love. And so when I gave my step five to my sponsor and talked about some of the things that happened to me as a child, there were some painful things that I don't go into. But suffice it to say, there were things that happened to me that I had never told anyone else in my life. And my sponsor received it in that space. And I felt such a relief. I felt like jello or something. I felt like gel. And I went and laid down for an hour. And that's when I had, and I thanked God for this experience, which we're instructed to do. And I had my spiritual experience. I had an unshakable experience of knowing that God was real and no one could tell me anything different. It changed the entire trajectory of my entire life after giving my step five. And in my step six and seven, looking at my character defects and praying the step seven prayer, I realized that I have no idea what's good or bad in this world about my character. God's going to tell me in real time. Sometimes my character defects help other people. Sometimes my desire to get into the center of an issue makes me a mouthpiece for people that I can walk with them in their issues. my perfectionism, which is really just hypervigilant control, and my attention to detail helps me with creative arts. One character defect that I've struggled with for a long time, and I like to call it people pleasing. I don't see it anywhere in the book. And also, someone said, as a sharer said, "Where are the people that I have pleased when I people please?" And what I realize is that I'm actually very kind and a manipulator. I want people to do what I want them to do when I want them to do it, and I will do nice things for them to get my result. And when they don't do it, I still get angry. So, kind manipulator instead of people pleasing, and hypervigilant control instead of perfectionism.
1 minute.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks for your service. In steps 8 and 9, when I wrote down that list, and when I realized that I needed to, for I forgave so many people in my life, and that I needed to make amends, a lot of living amends to people in my life. What I learned was that some of them gave me back so much love that it hurt. It was painful to think that I hurt these people. Someone, particularly one of my friends who I stole money from, told me, "Kendall, if I had known you needed the money, I would have just given it to you." He didn't want me to take it because I was moving. He didn't want to take the money from me. He was like, "Look, you can just keep it. Look, just consider it, man. I just don't want to talk about it. Look, we're cool. I don't want to lose you as a friend." It was literally hurting me for like to see how much love he was offering me in that space. And so to talk about where I am today, steps 10, 11, and 12, being blackmail proof, meaning when I take my step 10, I take my step 10 very seriously. I do it right away whenever I can. Particularly on page 84, it says, "Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear." It doesn't say at the end of the night or in the morning. It says right now, right when it happens. When these crop up, I ask God to remove them at once, right then. And then I talk to a fellow and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, right then. And then I go help someone. So for me, staying in 10, 11, 12 requires getting to service. And as I close, the last thing I'll say is that the most important two sentences for me in this book today: "Our practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity." This is the only place where immunity is in the first 164 pages of the big book. "Immunity with drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. When I help someone, I am protected from this disease. And I find that when other people help each other, that they have that same experience too. I'm so thankful for this fellowship. I'm thankful for the opportunity to share. And with that, I will pass. Thank you."